against the central area of Gaza Strip generally and Al-Nusayrat refugee camp particularly. Let's find out more details about what happened here over the last night, having this interview with this eyewitness.
The women were sitting over here. All of a sudden, an Israeli missile hit the place. The children were playing. We found their bodies torn into pieces. They were all civilians. 5 children and 3 women were killed without any reason. I am speechless. All the Gaza Strip is sentenced to death.
The current situation, whenever there is any kind of any attacks against the residential buildings, the Israeli occupation forces leave massive destruction and wide-scale damage and ruin in those residential buildings. In all areas of Gaza Strip, they are still insisting on targeting and destroying. Let's have another eyewitness in order to have more details about what happened in this massacre over the last night.
We are not affiliated with any faction. We're all civilians. I lost my 2 sons, my uncles and my cousins. They were turned into pieces. What was their crime? I was preparing the milk for my children when they were killed before they could even drink it. The missile targeted them directly.
This is the real manifestation of the ongoing Israeli brutality against the Palestinian people. Whenever there is any kind of any attack against the Palestinian residential buildings and areas, we have this kind of this misery. And the Palestinian people are completely devastated with these ongoing atrocities being committed day and night against the Palestinian people. To Abu Musabbih, the central area of Gaza Strip.
Syrian citizens flocked to the polls on Monday to participate in elections for the 4th legislature. Following the 2012 constitutional amendments, voting stations opened at 7 a.m. and remained open until 7 p.m. President Assad and senior Syrian figures participated in this election, emphasizing their commitment to taking responsibility for the country's future.
The parliamentary elections, along with the presidential and local council elections, were organized smoothly and on time, demonstrating that we are a nation governed by institutions. Syria is entering a new phase of openness, requiring citizens to play a role in shaping the country's policies while moving forward. We are hopeful that the new parliament will fulfill its responsibilities.
A total of 1,516 candidates competed for the 250 seats in the Syrian parliament. Citizens viewed these elections as an opportunity to shape the country's future by electing representatives who would address their needs and aspirations.
We opened at 7 in the morning with representatives of all candidates present to ensure transparency. Voter turnout has been good so far, and we expect it to increase throughout the day. We are providing all necessary facilities to citizens in collaboration with relevant authorities.
With high hopes for their country's future, Syrians demonstrated a strong sense of responsibility through widespread participation, signifying a positive step towards recovery in the Arab nation.
Let's hope that our elected representatives fulfill the promises outlined in our electoral programs and help our country overcome the economic challenges. The reconstruction of Syria is a top priority for all Syrians.
Participating in these elections is a duty regarding my country. I'm voting for those who will work for the betterment of the people's conditions and fulfill our aspirations, particularly in improving the economic situation. I hope the candidate who truly serves the country's best interests wins.
These elections took place amidst a positive atmosphere, fueled by the gradual opening that Syria is experiencing in various areas, paving the way for a return to normalcy. Experts believe the next parliament will play a significant role in shaping the country's future and setting its course for the next phase. Syrians are not only exercising their national rights and duty by voting in these elections, they are also showing the entire world that they can decide their fate and make a difference with their votes through democratic means. Ibrahim Wahdi, Damascus.
Rights campaigners are convinced that Israel is committing genocide and ethnic cleansing against Palestinians, actions blatantly supported by the United States and many EU nations. The death toll in Gaza continues to soar. People are starving and deprived of the most basic health care.
It's about an ideology, a Zionist ideology that was imported from Europe into our country, our own country of Palestine. And that ideology, its aim, I believe, in my own personal opinion, and it's been proven and it's been shown the case that they are trying to eliminate the Palestinian people and the Palestinian culture and history from all of the land of Palestine.
On Monday, after he met his Jordanian counterparts in Brussels, the EU's top diplomat, Joseph Borrell, again spoke out about the situation facing Palestinians.
I want to express my utter dismay over the unbearable climbing human cost and wide-scale destruction caused in Gaza by this conflict.
That's just the problem for EU policy critics. Instead of empty words, they are demanding economic sanctions and an arms embargo to be placed on the Israeli government. Additionally, the EU has been called upon to clarify its new plans to address the humanitarian crisis in Gaza.
We are looking at the possibility of facilitating medical evacuations jointly with member states and the WHO from the Gaza Strip to further neighboring countries in the region.
That response has been described as pitiful by those desperate to see adequate international support for dying Palestinians.
Europe stands with Israel.
European Commission boss Ursula von der Leyen set the tone for the EU when she travelled to Israel last October at the launch of Netanyahu's latest massacre. The EU's response, or lack thereof, to the atrocities has seriously undermined the bloc's credibility in the eyes of many. The question is being asked, is there literally no limit to what Israel can do before it faces consequences from the West? Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
It's been 9 years since the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action, JCPOA, also known as the Iran deal, was signed between Iran and several world powers in the Austrian capital, Vienna. The signatories to the 2015 landmark agreement were China, France, Germany, Russia, and the United Kingdom, apart from Iran and the United States. Under the agreement, the U.S. and the EU agreed to remove anti-Iran sanctions imposed over the years in exchange for Iran limiting its uranium enrichment and reducing its existing stockpile. The deal was eventually violated by the U.S. during the administration of President Donald Trump, who pulled out his country from the deal. That despite, Iran fully adhered to its part of the obligation under the JCPOA. Europeans also failed to salvage the accord by not complying to the accord.
The JCPOA had its pluses and its minuses. The biggest problem was that it was not protected. In other words, there were no real mechanisms to protect the deal if the Americans or the Europeans violated the agreement. And so when Obama began violating the deal, when he began to increase the sanctions, and of course the Europeans always obey the United States, there was no punishment. They paid no price for these violations. And then, of course, when Trump ultimately tore up the deal, it came at no political or economic cost for the United States.
The JCPOA was a result of 20 months marathon negotiations between the diplomats from Iran, the U.S., European countries, as well as China and Russia. These negotiations first led to the interim joint plan of action concluded in 2013 in Geneva, then a framework agreement concluded in April 2015 in Lausanne, and finally on July 14, 2015 in Vienna. It was announced that the final agreement has been clinched.
If you think about the guarantee of the JCPOA, it is important to notice that there is no way in international relations that finally force them states to obey a regulation or a deal or a treaty among them. And that is why every party can withdraw illegally but practically from a deal, and that is why JCPOA was not the only treaty or was not the only deal that United States withdrew during Trump era and other times. Trump withdrew from Paris Agreement, from NAFTA, from the deal with Russia, from the tariff deal with China, and some others, many others.
Over the next 2 years, following the signing of the deal, while Iran fully complied with the terms of the agreement, the unreliability of Americans was clear as they looked for pretexts to scale back their commitments. However, with Trump coming to the White House, as known for his close affiliation with the Israeli regime, the stage was set for nixing the accord. On May 8, 2018, Trump issued an executive order announcing that he was withdrawing the U.S. from the JCPOA.
Trump's unilateral move virtually led to the collapse of the implementation of key provisions of the JCPOA, as the two main parties to the agreement were Iran and the U.S. Despite the U.S.'s withdrawal, Iran decided to remain a signatory to the agreement with the remaining parties, but with implementation of reciprocal measures in line with its parliamentary law. Fateh Masumi, Tehran. Muharram is the first month on the Islamic calendar. Every year during this month, mourners take to the streets and gather in mosques and other religious places to take part in different ceremonies for the martyrdom anniversary of the third Shia Imam. The mourning rituals reach their peak on Ashura, the 10th day of Muharram, when Imam Hussein and his 72 companions were martyred in the Battle of Karbala in Iraq in the 7th century. On the first Friday of Muharram, similar ceremonies are held in dozens of countries across the globe to honor the youngest martyr of Karbala. Six-month-old Hazrat Ali Asghar was martyred on the day of Ashura. This year, Iranians marked the occasion in various cities and towns across the country. One of those ceremonies was held in the capital, Tehran, with thousands of mothers and their toddlers in attendance.
We are here for the innocence of those martyred in Karbala on the day of Ashura, especially the children like Ali Asghar. We are waiting for the arrival of Imam Zaman and we remain loyal to our leader Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei. We are upset about the children of Gaza as they are killed by the Zionist regime. We wish the mothers in Gaza can also hold their children safely and freely in their arms without any fear of losing them.
Muharram and Karbala are the symbol of the perennial struggle between truth and falsehood, just and unjust, the relevance and significance of Imam Hussein's epic uprising against the then corrupt and despotic ruler in the plains of Karbala go beyond the boundaries of time and space. These annual commemorations amount to the reaffirmation of people's pledge of allegiance to the principles that the grandson of Prophet Muhammad, peace be upon him, fought for.
As a mother, I'm here on this important day because Hazrat Ali Asghar, who was only 6 months old, was martyred by those who are very similar to Zionist regime killing innocent children in Gaza today. It's very heartbreaking. So all of these mothers here are praying for justice.
The movement, which has gripped the hearts and minds of people throughout history, is unfolding even today in Palestine, where Muslim men and women and children are killed and houses are flattened on a daily basis. What's unfolding in Palestine today is reminiscent of what took place 1,400 years ago, an apartheid regime which has occupied people's land, confiscated their properties, and driven them out of their homes, is today's version of the then tyrant empire at the time of the Battle of Karbala.
This year's mourners expressed their support for the oppressed Palestinians during Muharram ceremonies. Speaking up against injustice and oppression is the message of the Battle of Karbala and the legacy of Imam Hussein and Sayyida Zainab, peace be upon them. Fateh Masumi, Tehran.
In light of tensions in South Lebanon and the genocide in Gaza, many have compared the escalations to the Israeli war on Lebanon in 2006.
On the 12th of July 2006, Hezbollah resistance fighters captured two Israeli soldiers near the southern border in hopes of achieving a prisoner swap and freeing Lebanese prisoners held in Israeli jails. The result was a land, air, and sea blockade and Israeli bombs raining down across the country for 33 days.
Mohammed was barely 10 years old when he woke up to celebrations and fireworks after the resistance operation, just before the all-out war began.
I was too young to understand the political ramifications of what happened and everything. I just woke up to celebrations, and next thing we know, we have to go out the house, you know? And we moved to my grandma's house at the time. And the first day of the war, we had to stay in, the underground garage of the building. Back then, we thought it was safe.
Although many experts believe the 2006 war was part of a U.S. plot to create what it called a new Middle East, the Israeli regime had declared it aimed to crush the resistance. But Hezbollah's deterrence capability came as a shock.
Taking into consideration the Arab-Israeli wars from 1948 until 2006, I think this war was the first war that Israel failed to accomplish its mission to occupy Lebanon or to advance in the Lebanese soil. So it is really a turning point in the Arab-Israeli conflict.
Despite similarities, the war pursued by Palestinian resistance factions inside Gaza is even more significant now.
We still remember the command and control, which succeeded in 2006 in defeating Israel. And now there is a perfect performance of the command and control in Gaza. So it's continuing the 10th month.
As a child who experienced the war in 2006, Mohammed was asked how he relates the war to the ongoing genocide in Gaza.
It's shameful for me to even say that it's as close as what they're going through. And even though it was traumatizing, it did leave a mark on me, but it's nothing compared to what they're going through.
The war in 2006 left at least 1,000 Lebanese civilians killed, around 4,400 injured, and an estimated 1 million displaced. Maryam Saleh, Beirut.
Millions of Iranians commemorated the Day of Ashura, which marks the martyrdom of Imam Hussein, the third Shia Imam and the grandson of Prophet Muhammad, peace be upon him. In capital Tehran, people performed mourning rituals like no other, commemorating lives lost some 1,400 years ago. Imam Hussein was martyred along with his companions in the Battle of Karbala, fighting for justice and dignity against the army of the Umayyad Caliph, Yazid I.
Imam Hussein gave us a lesson in dignity so that we don't tolerate oppression. He stood up against oppression, so we should do the same.
Imam Hussein refused to pledge allegiance to the corrupt and oppressive ruler of his time and lost his life for his cause. To his followers, Imam Hussein is a symbol of standing up for what's right, no matter the cost. This is a lesson that parents want to teach their children from an early age.
We're trying to do for our son what our parents did for us so that he follows the path of the Prophet and his progeny and learn lessons from Imam Hussein and his cause.
The participants strive to serve the mourners of Imam Hussein in various ways, from offering water and dishes made specially for the occasion, to helping others with disabilities take part in the ritual.
Every Muharram we participate in these processions as a family, and today we give parish to the mourners of Imam Hussein.
One reason Muslims continue to commemorate Imam Hussein is the value they see in his message, one that continues to hold true today.
The main goal of Imam Hussein was to uphold the moral way of life, restore human dignity, and save humanity as a whole. Today, with what we are facing in our society and the Muslim world, especially in Gaza, it is our duty to participate in these processions and in doing so, show our solidarity and support for Gazans and other defenseless Palestinian people. We want to show them that just as Imam Hussein sacrificed his life, we will continue to support you and stand by you.
It's true that over 14 centuries have passed since the massacre of the Prophet's grandson and his family members and companions in Karbala, but Muslims believe that his message of resistance lives on in the face of modern-day oppression, such as the ongoing genocide in Palestine.
Death with dignity is better than a life of humiliation. That's the powerful message of Karbala. So Muslims and others continue to commemorate Imam Hussein and retell his story of resistance against oppression in hopes that one day justice and peace is actualized in the world. Maryam Azarcher, Tehran.
Choose to think better. Welcome to a better you. Visit us at parstoday.ir/en. IRIB English Radio.
الرحمن الرحيم. السلام عليكم ورحمة الله.
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints.
همه با وجود غده سرطانی اسرائیل مخالفیم.
All of us are opposed to the cancerous tumor Israel.
وجه مشترک همه وحدت امت اسلامی.
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
Illuminating quotes by Ayatollah Khamenei on Imam Hussein's uprising. All days of the year are essentially the same. It is human beings, their determination, and selfless efforts that make certain days prominent and turn them into a flag to guide other people. Ashura, the 10th of Muharram, is not in itself different from other days. It was Imam Hussein alayhi salam who gave life and meaning to that day and raised its position. It was the selfless efforts of Hussein ibn Ali's companions that made Ashura so important. Some people may question the value of the ceremonies for mourning Imam Hussein's martyrdom. They may say, if you want to speak about Imam Hussein's movement, just go ahead and speak about his movement. Why all the crying? This is a wrong assumption. It will be extremely hard to move ahead on this path in the absence of this emotional connection to the infallible Imams. This sense of friendship is of paramount importance, and it can be achieved through this emotional connection to the infallible Imams. Narrating the tragedies that happened to them is an attempt to establish this emotional connection. Similarly, praising their virtues through the mourning ceremonies is another way to form this emotional bond. Therefore, it is necessary to hold the mourning ceremonies and narrate the events of Ashura.
دنیای اسلام یک نسخه امروز دارد و اون اتحاد.
The world of Islam has one single prescription today, and that is unity. This prescription exists in all Islamic countries. Nations should be united.
Religious publicity in the month of Muharram is a case in point. The religious ceremonies for mourning Imam Hussein's martyrdom provide us with the best opportunity to promote Islam. We should utilize this opportunity in order to help distinguish right from wrong and create a beacon of guidance for the people. In the modern world, creating fitness is the main technique that is used by the enemies of the truth. In such a situation, the proponents of the truth should provide the people with as much insight and clear guidance as they can so that they do not get confused. Imam Hussein, peace be upon him, brought his dear ones to the desert of Karbala in order to clarify the truth. He knew what was going to happen, and yet he brought Zainab, his wives, his children, and his brothers with him. Like the day of Mubahila, it was again a matter of clarifying the truth and promoting Islam in the real sense of the word. That shows the importance of promoting Islam. If someone comes across a ruthless sultan who mixes up halal with haram and breaks his promise to God, they deserve living with the sultan in the hereafter. That is to say, When someone sees such a person, they should clarify the truth throughout their words and actions, just as Imam Hussein did. And he paid the price for it. Imam Hussein brought his dear ones and his wives and children to Karbala in order to clarify the truth.
Allah, I want to thank you. I want to thank you for all the things that you've done. You've done for me through all my years I've been lost. You guided me from all the ways that were wrong. Indeed, you gave me hope. Oh, Allah, I want to thank you. I want to thank you for all the things that you've done.
Option for today and a better tomorrow. IRIB English Radio. Our internet address is parstoday.ir/en.
Now from Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story.
What is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of international.
The Spotlight.
Hello and welcome to Spotlight. I'm Marzia Hashimi. Thanks so much for being with us. Well, on July 14, 2015, the so-called P5+1 in Iran signed the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action, the JCPOA. Now, the deal was between the U.S., Russia, China, England, France, and Germany, along with Iran. The agreement states that Iran would cut back on some of its nuclear research and activities, while the other side was supposed to lift nuclear sanctions on Iran. But what happened to it all, and where does everyone stand now, 9 years later? I'd like to welcome my guests to the program. Ray McGovern, a former CIA analyst out of Raleigh, North Carolina. And Scott Bennett, former U.S. Army psychological warfare officer out of San Francisco. Well, thanks so much. Good having both of you with us. Let me start this off in Raleigh. And Ray, I mean, what are your overall thoughts about that original 2015 JCPOA agreement?
Well, it was a crowning achievement of the Obama administration. And to see it just frittered away under Trump was a very sorrowful thing. And it all had to do with the influence of Israel, which was even greater on Trump than it was on Obama. And that's saying a lot. The Zionist entity has the U.S. Where it wants it. We're talking about anniversaries here. This is the 9th from the JCPOA, but it's the 20th since National Security Advisor General Brent Scowcroft went to the Financial Times and complained that Prime Minister Ariel Sharon had President Bush wrapped around his little finger, that he had President Bush mesmerized Those are the words of former National Security Advisor Brent Scowcroft, who then was chair of the President's Foreign Intelligence Advisory Board. That's how much Brent Scowcroft wanted American people to know how much influence Israel had, not least because of the invasion of Iraq, which was a major factor in prompting Bush and Cheney to go ahead and depose Saddam Hussein.
Yeah, well, it's too bad that no one listened to him at that time. Well, Scott, how is it that the Western hegemonic front can exert an extreme amount of pressure on Iran for developing its peaceful nuclear program while the Israeli regime, as Ray just talked about, I mean, has nuclear weapons? And, of course, as we know, is committing genocide as we speak. But these Western countries continue to send more weapons, support the regime, and, of course, not demanding any accountability.
Well, Marzia, it's wonderful to be with you again. It's such a joy, and blessings upon you and the great Republic of Iran and
Thank
their
you,
new
Scott.
President. I would say we're entering a phase of tremendous delusion, spiritual darkness, madness that is coming upon the West, and the United States and Israel are really crumbling and falling apart. They're losing their minds, and I don't say that cynically, I say it clinically as a former PSYOP officer. I look at these people suffering in the State Department, the CIA, the Biden administration, who really is just a puppet of Obama pulling the strings, but they are seriously detached from reality and delusional and believing their own lies, and they're becoming toxic from their own lies. So we're seeing, as you wisely put, the genocide of the Palestinians, but at the same time, the waking up of the world to the evil of Israel. And Israel will never be forgiven for its genocide and murder of women and children and civilians. And the United States, as Ray said, the great shame of Donald Trump was pulling the United States out of the JCPOA by believing and following these fools and these reckless, warmongering, bloody savages like John Bolton and Mike Pompeo and Nikki Haley and Mike Pence and all of these other bloodthirsty, corrupt criminals who were simply getting backhanded deals from the military-industrial complex. Trump wasn't smart enough or bold enough or righteous enough to stand up to them and do what the American people wanted. The American people wanted Iran and America to be at peace, to reunite, to have a relationship, and that is still our desire in America. No one has a feverish hatred for Iran except the Jewish Zionist Talmudic demoniacs. And sadly, as Ray said, they control and strangle the American Congress. But I do think their time is up. And I think the emergence of the BRICS multipolar world, the Shanghai Cooperation Organization, those are all rising as the West is descending, but it's very dangerous because as the West descends, they become more and more maniacal, psychotic, and delusional. But there is, I think, great hope because as Russia, Iran, China emerge stronger, the world will flock to their side because they are representing peace and sovereignty while the West represents slavery and destruction and war.
Interesting comments. Well, Ray, I mean, if we look at, I mean, because Scott said we're on the verge of this changing world, but we look at, for example, the Europeans, one, they didn't keep to their side of the deal after the U.S. Withdrew. And on the other side, we saw just last month, actually, with the IAEA and with the help of the U.K., France, and Germany, actually increase the sanctions on Iran again. So, I mean, on the one hand, Scott says that we're perhaps in a transition. On the other hand, we still have the whole Western hegemonic entity acting illogical and aggressive.
And delusional, as Scott also said. That's the problem. I think that Netanyahu has so much at stake here, even his personal freedom. He needs to stay in this game. I can only explain his desire to go up against Hezbollah by saying, my God, he's risking it all. And what he thinks has got to be that when he gets mired down with Hezbollah, as well as in Gaza, the U.S. will have to come in. That's his calculation. In other words, I find him crazy as a fox. Now, most people would say, well, that's crazy. The U.S. is not going to come in. Well, look at the election year. Look at how malleable Biden and his advisors have been. Look how they all proudly claim themselves to be Zionists. Some of them are also Jewish, but Jewish doesn't matter here. That's a reputable fake. It's Zionism that's the problem. And our commander-in-chief and our president, of course, has said more than once, I am very proud to be a Zionist. So what he is doing is supporting Israel 150%. In an election year, that has to be 155%, so to speak. Mm-hmm. And I dare say, I fear that Netanyahu is right in saying when push comes to shove, Hezbollah gets in, the U.S. will have to come to Israel's aid. And then the question, of course, will be whether they want to broaden it to Iran. And that will be an even more serious problem and mistake.
Yeah, for sure. Well, Scott, I mean, your thoughts on the fact that the going back to the JCPOA, I mean, that the main part of the agreement, the United States, I mean, it is a country which has used weapons of mass destruction, and yet it wants to control a country like Iran, which has not been the aggressor of any nation, of course, since prior to the Islamic Revolution. I mean, so from the beginning, when we look at this, I mean, this hypocrisy in general, of course, more of this hypocrisy has been exposed during the last 9 months of this genocide and seeing these international entities just not reacting. But your thoughts on that? I mean, it is so difficult to swallow in so many ways that that country is telling Iran that they cannot have their nuclear, their peaceful nuclear research and activities while they have nuclear weapons. I mean, your take on this, what should independent countries do when trying to deal with this hegemonic entity?
Well, I think we're witnessing, Marzia, a tremendous shift in the fulcrum point of the geopolitical fortunes of the West compared to the Euro-Asian countries. Specifically, the game changer has been Russia, Iran, China, India, creating this economic alliance, which is a subtle political alliance as well, and a military alliance to a certain extent. So Russia has changed the game by challenging the West's war agenda against Russia in Ukraine. Russia entered to stop the NATO expansion. It is simultaneously reinforcing, I believe, the political agreements and alliances between Russia and Iran, Russia and North Korea, Russia and China, Russia and Vietnam, and India, of course, too, entering into agreements with Iran. These are very important geopolitical leverage points. It's a buoyancy, if you will, that is elevating Iran above the reach, above the murderous, bloody claws of death and destruction of the West. Iran is being elevated up by the buoyancy created by these international economic political organizations and agreements. And Russia will no doubt not allow Iran to fall. So this notion of Netanyahu, who I think is a dead man walking and is very soon going to depart from this earth by his own military abandoning him because they realize the entire genocide is going to be hung around Israel's neck like a rubber tire and ignited on fire very soon. The world will never forgive Israel for this murderous rampage. And I have thought and hoped that every country would expel Israel's ambassadors and passports and not have anything to do with them. But I think Russia's rise is simultaneously going to nullify the West's additional delusion that they can step in and defend Israel from its attack upon Hezbollah. I don't think that's going to happen. I think Russia would step in, Iran would step in, North Korea, China would step in subtly, invisibly, but we would see weapons with the Houthis, that would sink every American ship in the Persian Gulf, in the Indian Ocean, in the Red Sea, in the Mediterranean. I think we're really witnessing the rise of these other countries to militarily defend each other. And Iran is included in that. And the West, of course, is falling apart. The French are falling apart. The British, the Germans. The Germans, I think, will collapse in a mighty political revolution because, of course, the Nord Stream 2 pipeline was destroyed by Olaf Scholz, obediently looking the other way because his masters in the United States told him to, Anthony Blinken, Sullivan, and the rest of these people. So as the West begins to crumble and crack and decay in its own political turmoil and revolution, as leaders are replaced, I think it is only going to accelerate the freedoms and the liberties of countries like Iran to pursue exactly the energy, nuclear energy agenda that it wants without any respect to Israel's animosity or belligerency.
Okay. Well, what about that, Ray? Because we see the Israeli regime itself has nuclear weapons. Of course, no one is holding the regime responsible for that. No accountability. And, of course, it was that regime that also pushed Trump even more to try to leave the agreement. So where are you? Where are we right now? Scott says he thinks that we're in this transition period. And with the rise of the BRIC nations, how do you see it? Your assessment of where it all stands right now, when we look at the position of the Israeli regime and we look at the absolute support from the Western hegemonic front, your assessment of it all, Ray?
My assessment comes from my experience as a current intelligence officer and analysis, in other words, a glorified journalist. My focus is on the next 4 months.
Okay.
They are critical months. Biden, whether he runs or not, the Democrats are in very, very serious trouble. Now, what does Netanyahu have to do with this? He could spark a conflagration with Hezbollah trying to bring Iran in, and whether the U.S., whether the people who are advising or making decisions for Biden, Blinken, Sullivan, whether they will do Netanyahu's bidding or not is a major question, whether it's good for the United States or not. So I would fear that one of the first things they would do would say, oh, Iran is actually now developing a nuclear weapon, despite the fact that the intelligence agencies beginning in 2007 said that Iran stopped working on a nuclear weapon in 2003. Every year since has ratified that judgment, saying they're still not doing that. But there have been noises, actually, among serious senior generals in Iran saying, well, maybe we ought to reassess that. So what I see is a provocation by Israel trying to get the U.S. involved, not only against Hezbollah, but against Iran. And that's what I see in the next 4 months because of the presidential election and the felt need by these Zionists in power to do everything they can to protect Israel and, by extension, protect the money they get from Israel lobby APEC.
Hmm. Wow, that's interesting. Well, Scott, what do you think? I mean, your assessment, well, Ray has said in the next 4 months he sees this happening. When you look at the overall situation in the region and beyond, what would be your prognosis?
I hope I'm wrong, Marzia, but I think we will not have an election in November. I think the Democrats are going to trigger a crisis, false flag events, perhaps a strike upon America and blame it on Russia, blame it on Iran, blame it on someone else, blame it on a Trump supporter. They may assassinate Biden. They may assassinate Kamala Harris. They could replace him with Gavin Newsom or Megan Whitmer or Michael LeBron Robinson, also known as Michelle Obama. They could trigger all sorts of internal combustion to create a police state environment where the Democrats hold on to power, and the rhinos would only be happy to do so as well. They've betrayed the American people by invading across the southern border, destroying the dollar, entering America into a war against Russia. I was there. I was in Belgorod and Cherubinka. I had drones attacking my hotel. So I saw with my own eyes the West's war against Russia, and I've prepared a war crimes report over it. But I sadly predict over the next 4 or 5 months, we are not going to have a smooth transition and election. I think it's going to be really explosive, and they're trying to do this to create a war so they can hold on to power. Wars are very convenient smoke screens for political tyrants. I hope I'm wrong. But in that event, we need to be prepared for the fall of Rome. And I think that's where America is going towards, fall of Rome and a revolution, civil war, where I do think the people will emerge far more non-interventionist, more isolationist, more pacifist than we've ever been. All of this started in 9/11 with the great juggernaut going into Afghanistan, Iraq, then Libya, then Syria. Now with ambitions against Iran, against Ukraine. I think that's at an end. The American people have never wanted this, but it's taken a long time for them to wake up. But I do think we're going to be entering a time of severe combustion, and I would not doubt if the elections are scuttled or suspended by some national emergency that is self-inflicted.
Wow. Well, that's definitely quite interesting. We actually need to do a show specifically on that and dealing with the upcoming election. Hopefully we'll get you back on for that, Scott, in general. But Ray, I mean, looking back at Iran and the direction that the martyred President Ibrahim Raisi was taking Iran in and looking towards the global south, looking east, your thoughts and your assessment of that, because there are some, for example, in Iran who would say, okay, we need to then try to restart the dealings with the United States and see if we can get the sanctions taken off this time and perhaps revive the JCPOA. Your thoughts, Ray?
Well, I think that your new president is exercising due caution and a willingness to consider all options. I wouldn't close off the notion that in 4 months there might be a more respectful regime in Washington. Meanwhile, Iran now is part of BRICS. That's big. Iran now is very close to concluding an agreement with Russia, which is close to a mutual defense treaty. Yes. That was almost ready about two months ago. So Iran has been accepted by these giants, not only Russia, but China. The question is whether these neurotic, whether these people in charge, or whether it's Biden or the people around him, recognize that or care a whit about Americans and what they feel, and desire first and foremost to make sure that they stay in power so that they don't lose the election, so that they don't lose their freedom, because each and every one of them, not only Hunter, but Daddy and Blinken and Sullivan, they got the goods on these people. And if that other fellow comes in, there's every reason to expect they could end up with serious jail time. So those are personal incentives. So hold on to your hat, strap onto your seatbelt, and above all, don't be provoked into doing something that the U.S. wants you to do.
Right, right. Well, Scott, let's talk about this phase right now that we're in. How dangerous is the message that the world has received during this last nine and a half months with what has been taking place in Gaza? That basically it sends a message of might makes right, I mean, and that each and every country has to fend for itself and has to be as strong as it possibly can. I mean, what type of scenario are we looking at with this type of mentality now?
Well, Netanyahu, of course, is a bloodthirsty savage who's lost his mind, and the images of little girls with their faces blown off and little boys with their legs missing and entire families destroyed under rubble. These are crimes against humanity. These are war crimes. And the United States has blood on its hands, and everyone in Congress has blood on their hands for financing and providing the weapons. And Netanyahu's alleged appearance over the United States when he comes, which I hope he'll be arrested for. Someone hopefully will do that. But he is coming over to try and gin up a warmongering hysteria, bloodlust. But it's inauthentic because the American people are not behind this. You will see more protesters in Washington, I think, than ever before to put a wall up against this war. But Netanyahu is also being hung out to dry by his own political leaders, who realize it's only a matter of time before Israel is exposed for killing their own citizens in the Hannibal directive, and for engineering, in fact, this October 7th attack with the ambition to use it as an excuse for genocide, to steal the oil and gas resources in the Mediterranean and to steal the real estate of the Gaza Strip. This has always been their agenda. They thought the world was going to look the other way, but they didn't. Iran stood up and called them out and stood to defend the Palestinians, and other countries have been rising up. Turkey, Egypt, Syria, Jordan, Malaysia, all of them, I think, have a great deal of offense by what has happened to these poor Palestinians. And the world has too. All over the United States, colleges and universities and students are rising up. That's going to kick in more in the fall when they return to school, and all over Europe. So we've seen this great awakening to the murderous savagery of the Jewish, Israeli, Talmudic Zionists, and we've seen the face of the devil himself in their reflection. And that's something no one's ever going to forget. And you've seen the awakening of the BRICS nations and Asia and China and Russia. And I think you're also going to see the collapse of these European regimes who are going to be splitting apart. This is not something that the West, the Western people, the Christian people of the West, of America, of Europe, want any part of. And they've never seen this sort of brutality before. I know the Palestinians have. I know people in the Middle East have seen it. They've lived with it. Right. But in America, that has lived between two oceans and slept in the fatness of luxury in their economy, they've never seen this before. And I think they're finally going to step up and start acting to it. We are in that moment of transition.
All right. And on that note, I thank both of you for being with me on this spotlight. Ray McGovern, former CIA analyst out of Raleigh, North Carolina. Scott Bennett, former U.S. Army psychological warfare officer out of San Francisco. I appreciate you guys being with me again. And appreciate you staying with us for another spotlight. I'm Marzia Hashimi. Goodbye.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran.